How can one word, one acronym actually, represent so much hope? How can this word take more than 20 years of research and somehow package it up into a little code for the evolution of medicine? How can one word bring science's greatest wonders and ambitions from the laboratory and into the mainstream?
Okay, you've got me hooked. I'm taking the bait.
Yes.
Before we go any further, you gotta tell me, what is this word?
CRISPR.
CRISPR, huh? It's the gene editing technology that has changed patients' lives and maybe even medicine as a whole. Definitely not joking about the weight of that one little word.
I don't joke, Tom, and you know this. But it's not like CRISPR is some savior. It's really come to represent a bigger concept that is changing medicine, gene editing.
So welcome to Databook, everybody. I'm your co-host, Tom Castles.
And I'm Jack Murtha. Today on Databook, we're telling the story, obviously, of CRISPR.
But that's only until we switch lanes and pivot to the story of Sangamo. It's a gene editing company that has nothing to do with CRISPR. Actually, Sangamo uses a gene editing technique that no one else in the world does. Period. And guess what, everybody? It's working.
So these days, it's looking a lot like Sangamo is the gene editing company that did not need CRISPR.
So we're about to really get going on this episode of Databook, but before we fully turn up the heat, we want to give a shout out to an article called The Heroes of CRISPR. It was published in the journal Cell, and it's where we got a lot of the information for this story.
Gotta give credit where it's due. Anyway, our story begins in a Spanish town on the Mediterranean Sea. It's 1989, and we're looking at this PhD student named Francisco Mojica. He's studying a microbe that grew up in the super salty marshes of this place. His hometown, Santa Pola.
So Mojica and his advisor are really falling in love with these microbes, and it's because they're so resistant to salt. They're learning that the microbe's environment plays a big role in this. The environment actually somehow cuts the microbe's genome into these little bitty tiny fragments.
And these fragments seem like a big deal. Mojica hadn't seen them before, so he examines them, and he finds that these little tiny genome fragments contain several copies of a repeated sequence that was totally unique to this microbe.
So like all the world's finest scientists, this one small revelation sends Mojica on a decade-long scientific journey. Pretty soon, he finds similar structures in other organisms too, and a similar finding in other research all the way over in Japan.
And that distance is important because it meant that all over the globe, these microbes were doing something that seemed pretty crucial to their existence, but it was something that no one had ever understood. Nobody had grasped it.
At first, Mojica calls these repeating structures sirsers. Probably not the best name, if you ask me. In my humble opinion, I'm pretty glad that he changed it over.
Oh, sure.
Pretty soon, he changes the name up, and let me get a drum roll here. He calls them CRISPR.
CRISPR. So CRISPR is an acronym for a phrase that's kind of a mouthful. Clustered, regularly interspaced, palindromic repeats. Over the next decade, Mojica finds these CRISPRs in a bunch of microbes. But still, no one knows what they really do.
Plenty of people are guessing, though. But nobody really knows until about 2003, when Mojica has yet another breakthrough.
Thanks to more data and better tech, he's able to take a better look at the genetic makeup of these microbes. And this time around, he decides to analyze the spacers between the mysterious structures. So they're not the little fragments, they're the stuff that separates them.
And it turns out that those spaces are really important. Mojica's examining a CRISPR locus from a strain of E. coli when he notices that the spacer was resistant to a virus that usually gives E. coli big problems. He keeps analyzing all these different spacers, and he finds out that a lot of them are protected against viruses.
That's the aha moment. CRISPR, he figured, must have been some sort of adaptive immune system. It was something that learned on the go and shielded microbes from infections.
And this is a really big deal. Mojica goes out celebrating as soon as he figures this out.
And he drinks a little bit of cognac.
maybe a little bit too much cognac, and immediately following gets to work writing a paper. Journals are hesitant to publish his findings, and it doesn't really get out until a little bit later in 2005.
So during all of this, other scientists start looking at CRISPR too. This team from France that's funded by the military comes to a pretty similar conclusion as Mojica. And then there's this other French expert who ultimately finds that CRISPR immunity comes down to a super precise DNA sequence. And that's the CRISPR-Cas9 finding.
This Dutch PhD starts cloning and sequencing this genetic material, and he begins working on creating CRISPR arrays in his lab. And he finds out that it works. His name's John van der Oost, and he becomes the first person to program immunity into an organism. It's all thanks to CRISPR.
From there, the scientific community really starts to see the potential that CRISPR has for other animals, maybe even humans, and they keep grinding away.
Pretty soon, more scientists, more bright minds are looking into this. They're keeping the research going. They're exploring genome editing in all sorts of different organisms. By 2013, the search term CRISPR hits Google hard. And that's when it becomes clear, CRISPR might be able to do something big for humans.
So just imagine, this is a whole new frontier for medicine. The CRISPR hype train gets rolling on the tracks, and it is speeding, and it never really stops. You have startup companies, big mega corporations, investors, established researchers, wide-eyed young grad students, the tech press, everybody. They're all looking at CRISPR.
Of course, at the same time, CRISPR is attracting plenty of naysayers, and it still does today. There are studies out there casting doubt on its power and even its safety. But no matter how you look at it, you can argue that CRISPR is sparking a gene editing revolution.
Yeah, and we still don't know how CRISPR will ultimately play out and what it will contribute to medicine or won't contribute. But all of a sudden, the idea of physically changing a genome is not science fiction. It is real, and it is here, and it is in our hands.
But the truth is, gene editing had been here.
Or at the very least, gene editing had been in the works in other places.
Way back in the mid-90s, a scrappy young company had begun exploring a gene editing technique of its own, and it had nothing to do with CRISPR. The name of this company? This disruptor?
Sangamo.
To better understand the quiet rise of Sangamo, we reached out to Danny Funt. He's a freelance writer who wrote about the company for Healthcare Analytics News. Before he typed a single word, he spent quite some time searching for the right subject.
Months, I believe. I asked him for a profile on a heavyweight in genetics, precision medicine, genomics, something like that. He scoured the space and settled on Sangamo.
It looks like it was a really smart move.
The day after we published his excellent 3,500-word story, Sangamo announced a $3 billion partnership with Kite. That's one of the leaders in the CAR T space.
Yeah, so we're pleased to welcome Danny Funt to Databook. Danny, how's it going?
Doing great. Happy to be speaking with you guys.
Hey, Danny. We're really happy to have you. So to start off, what led you to choose to chart the history and potential future of Sangamo?
Well, you mentioned that I spent quite a bit of time before I did any reporting trying to make sense of this space of gene editing and who are the real players doing interesting work that could actually be consequential for medicine sometime in the relatively near future. But you didn't have to be looking for anything in particular to hear this international news in November when doctors in Oakland using Sangamo's zinc finger nucleases, or a gene editing technology, edited the genes of a 34-year-old man, actually, for the first time ever in the history of gene editing. So this was the first time that gene editing was performed in vivo for a patient. And although we're still waiting to hear the success of those clinical trials, it was a major breakthrough. And I wanted to understand who exactly is this player who's using a technology that's not what we've been hearing about when we think about gene editing.
Sure. So most of gene editing has been done outside the body. This was inside. Big deal.
That's right. Yeah, the The greatest difficulty for advancing gene editing is how you deliver the medicine to the specific area of need. So it's one thing if you edit cells. It's awfully complicated, obviously. But still, it's one thing if you edit cells outside the body and then transfuse them back to the patient. But in this case, they delivered a benign virus directly to this man's liver, and they edited cells within the liver. And hopefully, the body will continue to produce the edited cells that will combat this disease that's been debilitating this guy for so many years of his life.
When everyone thinks of gene editing, I think most people automatically default to CRISPR. Danny, can you tell us why CRISPR is so ubiquitous?
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned that. I have a line in my piece where I say, if you mention gene editing, the first thing people will respond is, oh, so you mean CRISPR. And that actually happened when I was reporting my piece. I'd talk about it with friends, and even people who don't follow this kind of genomic medicine make that assumption. The reason why CRISPR has become ubiquitous is because it's much, much easier to develop and test than the technology that Sangamo is developing. It's sort of been a blessing and a curse for Sangamo that they dominate the intellectual property of the technology they've developed, and it's a much, much more complicated type of medicine that requires a large inventory of proteins to design a particular medicine for a patient. So CRISPR is very straightforward and easy for someone in a postdoc, let's say, to practice with.
So we know what Sangamo is using instead of CRISPR. How does it stack up to CRISPR? Is it better?
Yeah, that's the big question, obviously, the biggest focus of debate. In certain ways, it's not better on a simple level, that it's more complicated and expensive. Trials show that it can be more precise when it comes to targeting a specific nucleotide in the cell. And a huge component of this, as I mentioned, is delivery. So how do you deliver the medicine to the specific part of the body that needs treatment? Because zinc fingers are smaller, they're easier to package in a virus, let's say, that you're using to deliver the medicine. And that's a big, big advantage as they expand treatment to a larger variety of diseases.
I'm curious about the human side of this. What does this mean for sick people?
Right. And as you sort of alluded to, there's good reason to check our optimism about how imminent any of this medicine will be widely available. I spoke with the doctor in Oakland who supervised the treatment of that patient I mentioned last November. And he said that there's been a type of cell therapy that's been used to treat patients with this metabolic disease for the last decade. And although it's far from perfect, it's something. And he said, as excited as we are about Sangamo's medicine, it certainly would be at least another decade before that's widely available. So a lot of the people who I spoke with who have very rare diseases are very excited about these clinical trials because there's good reason for a company like Sangamo to begin testing their medicine on rare diseases. The FDA approval process is much simpler and less expensive if you're targeting a disease population that's in the thousands rather than many millions. So if some of these groups that represent people with rare diseases like Hunter syndrome, which is what this man in Oakland suffers from, they're very optimistic that, you know, something finally could treat what for so long has been a basically untreatable disease.
Is the hope good? Is it something that could be setting us up for a letdown?
Well, definitely with a company like Sangamo, one thing that caught my eye about them is that they've been in the game for so long, right? They've been developing this technology for over 20 years. And so even though they're ramping up their efforts to go from research to treatment, they still operate with a very long-term perspective. And when we see an enormous investment in their medicine, like what you alluded to, I don't think those companies have any delusions about how imminently this type of medicine could hit the market. One thing that I asked people at Sangamo and people who might have a competing interest is, will one of these technologies eventually prevail, right? Will CRISPR or Sangamo's zinc fingers or Talens or any other technology eventually prove to be the optimal way of treating diseases that might benefit from gene editing. And they sort of hedged on how that'll play out. And of course, the truth of the matter that I alluded to at the end of my piece is that if it's possible that none of these treatments is the ultimate best solution, that there's plenty of research still going on and maybe something entirely different from CRISPR and Sangamo's zinc fingers is what's going to solve gene editing once and for all.
Sangamo had quite a big day after your story went live, a $3 billion day. Did they deserve that $3 billion? Is this something that's real or is this hype?
I don't know how much we should read into these kind of investments. I know that even before this $3 billion deal, in the last few years, Sangamo had got some huge investments from people, from companies like Pfizer. Pfizer invested $175 million in a hemophilia treatment that Sangamo is developing. So that's definitely not something to be dismissive of. But at the same time, I don't know if a $3 billion deal implies that Sangamo is truly the leader in this field. I think we'll sort of have to wait and see.
A very interesting part of your piece details a sort of gold rush that's been going on in the gene tech space for quite some time. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Right. Yeah. When Sangamo went public in 2000, that was at a real feverish time of enthusiasm on Wall Street for any company that was doing anything in the genomics space. There were jokes that I alluded to in my piece about just how seemingly compulsively enthusiastic that investing was. And I don't know if they knew it or not at the time, but as we've seen, this technology takes a long time to develop. And the former chief scientific officer at Sangamo told me that things are a lot more complicated than some of that early investing suggested. Now, obviously, when we see a $3 billion investment in Sangamo just recently, and we see hundreds of millions being poured into the space for Sangamo alone in the last 2 years, obviously the investors' enthusiasm hasn't cooled off too much, but it's definitely not at the state that it was when Sangamo was going public and when anything in this space was met with this type of gold rush mentality that you described.
So is it a story of groundbreaking treatments? Is it a story of ground-shaking monetary investments? Is it a story of people who have been suffering for far too long without the help they need?
I had a hard time pressing the real thought leaders in this field to engage in that sort of projection about the 5, 10, 20-year vision for how this is all going to play out. I think that they're reluctant to do that, A, because there's just so many variables in play. I mean, some of the earliest clinical trials for CRISPR and for Sangamo's medicine are just now underway, so who knows how those will go. But also because, well, it is exciting and daunting and captivating to imagine the end of the road of developing this kind of medicine. In the meantime, I think that there's real clear benefits that are accessible in the not too distant future. So if people with the kind of metabolic diseases that Sangamo's first trials are seeking to treat can have their lives radically improved by a in vivo gene editing treatment, that alone is reason to be optimistic and to be confident that this is worthwhile research. And whether or not it'll transform medicine, as people who tend to discuss genomic medicine tend to focus on, we'll wait and see. But in the meantime, there's some real unmet need that this medicine could hopefully address in the not too distant future.
When you spoke with these guys who are heading up the team at Sangamo, what sort of vibes were you picking up for these guys? You know, they've been around for the long haul. It seems to me like they got the grit to see this through as far as it could go. What sort of feelings are you getting from them?
They've had a leadership overhaul over the last few years, and the new people that they've installed are really trying to transition from the research that they've been doing for the last two decades to finally taking this medicine to the bedside and treating patients. One thing that really stood out in my conversations is that it took very little from me when I brought up CRISPR or any of their other competitors for them to become, I think, understandably defensive and have seemingly a list of bullet points that they've said many times in their head ready to go about all the the ways that Sangamo is in some ways just as good as CRISPR, in other ways perhaps even better. They've been cautiously optimistic because these trials are definitely exciting, but even with huge investments, this is not going to be a commercial medicine anytime soon.
What kind of intelligence and experience and determination are we dealing with here?
Right. Well, people might doubt whether Sangamo zinc finger nucleases are the gene editing technology of the future. Nobody would doubt the brain power that this company has amassed and that's been toiling away at developing zinc fingers for the last two decades. They have been the unquestioned leaders in their field, and I think it's to their credit that although they dominated the intellectual property since basically their beginning, they have cultivated some really impressive minds in this space, and those people have been at the lead for quite some time. Ed Rebar, their chief technology officer, has been at the company basically since the beginning. He did some of the earliest work in proving that zinc finger nucleases could be a viable medicine, and he continues to lead the efforts to develop that medicine into a practical treatment. They have about 175 employees, 40 of whom are investigators. They've invested hundreds of millions of dollars to pursue this type of medicine. And although they've been based in Richmond, California, which is in the East Bay, they're moving their corporate headquarters to the biotech hub in San Francisco. So they are serious about transitioning from decades of research and perfecting this medicine to finally converting it into a money-making treatment.
What do you think we can expect from Sangamo in terms of headlines and maybe new treatment offerings? What should we keep an eye out for?
I really wanted to know how the man who received treatment in November is doing. I think they gave mixed signals about how long it would take for the success of that treatment to be evident. At one point, it seemed like it would take a few months, and later it seemed like it might take a few more months. So even though it's just one patient, I'm curious to see how he's doing for his sake and for the sake of people with his disease. In the long term, though, I think as they continue to roll out new treatments for different diseases and expand their clinical trials, that'll be interesting. CRISPR companies like CRISPR Therapeutics are starting trials for its medicine that would address similar diseases. So I'm curious to see Sangamo's promise that if some of these early trials are successful, they could very easily extend the medicine to hundreds, if not 1,000, other related diseases. I'm curious to see if that is the fact and how long that would take.
Great. Well, Danny, it's always a pleasure to connect with you. Thank you so much for coming on Databook.
Thanks, guys. Appreciate it.
So the Sangamo story illustrates what cutting-edge medicine might be capable of, what it seems like it's capable of. But for each individual advancement, for each separate corner of innovation, there is a unifying theme. We see it over and over again. And on this week's Insight, we're going to try to unravel this. Every coverage area of healthcare analytics news blends together and works to tell a bigger story, to reach a bigger goal. You don't have big data without analytics. Well, you can, but what good is it? You don't have big data without privacy and security. You don't have really costly gene editing without some sort of push toward value-based care.
I really think that the whole health IT community is a classic case of a rising tide lifts all boats. This whole group of all health IT execs and C-suites and anyone involved in these various healthcare tech silos, each of them depends on one another's advancements. This is a community, and it needs to be treated as such. Each of these different silos advances healthcare one step at a time. And while they move forward, they may or may not realize that they're helping move forward the entire continuum of care and all of healthcare.
It's kind of funny because when somebody first enters this field, when they first start getting a feel for the landscape and everything that's going on and what it all means, some of these subjects seem kind of disconnected. They don't seem like they should belong together. Why, for instance, am I talking about population health and value-based care in the same breath? Why is a data site covering population health? Well, population health is sort of the embodiment of big data and analytics with a goal toward moving toward value-based care. Everything really is connected in this space.
You can count on us for that kind of coverage. When our reporters come knocking on your door, it could be for your successes or your failures, but understand that either way, it's an opportunity for you to advance healthcare.
But it all goes back to the larger conversation. And that's something that we think is really important to keep in mind as we continue to explore this field.
And on that note, I suppose it's time to wrap up the third edition of Data Book. I want to thank everyone for tuning in.
So please join us next week. And in the meantime, check out hcanews.com. There you can read Danny Font's brilliant story on Sangamo. And you could also stay on top of the day's news. Also, check us out on Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, Instagram, at @HCA_news. So I'm Jack Murtha.
And I'm Tom Castles.
And we'll catch you soon.